Chapter 6. Problems of Credit Policy. 1. Prefatory Remark. Section 1. The Conflict of Credit Policies. Since the time of the currency school, the policy adopted by the governments of Europe and America with regard to the issue of fiduciary media has been guided, on the whole, by the idea that it is necessary to impose some sort of restriction upon the banks in order to prevent them from extending the issue of fiduciary media in such a way as to cause a rise of prices that eventually culminates in an economic crisis. But the course of this policy has been continually broken by contrary aims. Endeavors have been made by means of credit policy to keep the rate of interest low, cheap money, i.e. low interest, and reasonable, i.e. high prices, have been aimed at. Since the beginning of the 20th century, these endeavors have noticeably gained in strength during the war, and for some time after it they were the prevailing aims. The strange vicissitudes of credit policy cannot be described except by passing in review the actual tasks that it has had to solve and will have to solve in the future. Although the problems themselves may always be the same, the form they assume changes. And for the very reason that our task is to strip them of their disguises, we must first study them in their contemporary garb. In what follows, separate considerations will be given to such problems, first, as they exhibited themselves before the war, and then, as they have exhibited themselves in the period immediately after the war. 2. Problems of the Credit Policy Before the War. Section 2. Peel's Act. Peel's Bank Act and the ideas on which it was based still sets the standard by which credit policy is ultimately governed nowadays. Even those countries that do not follow the example of the English bank legislation, or do not follow it so faithfully as others, have yet not been able to withstand its influence altogether. Here we are confronted with a strange phenomenon. While the economic literature of all countries was directing the most violent and passionate attacks against the system of having a fixed quota of the note issue not backed by metal, while people were untiring in calling Peel's Act the unfortunate legislative product of a mistaken theory, while the currency principle continued to be represented as a system of erroneous hypotheses that had long been confuted, yet one legislature after another took steps to limit the issue of uncovered banknotes. And, remarkably enough, this procedure on the part of the governments evoked but little censure, if any at all, from those whose views on banking theory should logically have led them to most severely condemn it. To start from the banking principle, which denies the possibility of an overissue of banknotes and regards elasticity as their essential characteristic, is necessarily to arrive at the conclusion that any limitation on the circulation of notes, whether they are backed by money or not, must prove injurious, since it prevents the exercise of the chief function of the note issue, the contrivance of an adjustment between the stock of money and the demand for money without changing the objective exchange value of money. It might easily have appeared desirable to Tuke's followers that provision should be made for backing that part of the note circulation that was not backed by metal. But logically, they should have condemned the prescription that a certain proportion was to be maintained between the stock of metal and the note circulation. There is an irreconcilable contradiction, however, between the theoretical arguments of these writers and the practical conclusions that they draw from them. Scarcely any writer that need be taken seriously ventures to put forward proposals that might fundamentally disturb the various systems for restricting the unbacked note issue. Not a single one definitely demands their complete abolition. Nothing could show the inherent uncertainty and lack of independence of modern banking theory better than this inconsistency. That the note issue must somehow be restricted in order to guard against serious evils is still accepted today as the essence of government wisdom in matters of banking policy, and the science which claims to have produced proof to the contrary always ends up by deferring to this dogma, which nobody is nowadays able to prove and everybody thinks himself able to refute. The conservatism of the English hinder them from meddling with a law which stands as a monument to an intellectual contest which went on for many years and in which the best men of the time participated, and the example of the world's chief bank influences all other banks. The conclusions of two generations of economists have not been able to shake the opinions which are supposed to be the results of practical banking experience. Many serious errors are involved in the currency principle. The most serious lies in its failure to recognize the essential similarity of banknotes and bank deposits. Its opponents have skillfully discovered these weak spots in the system and directed their sharpest attacks accordingly. But the doctrine of the currency school does not stand or fall by its views on the nature of checks and deposits. It is enough to correct it on this one point, to take its propositions concerning the issue of notes and apply them also to the opening of deposit accounts, to silence the censures of those who adhere to the banking principle. That its mistake on this point is of small significance in comparison with that made by the banking principle can hardly need further discussion. And in any case, it does not seem an inexcusable mistake to have made if we take into account the relatively backward development of even the English deposit system at the time when the foundations of the classical theory of banking were being laid, and if we further consider the ease with which the legal differences between payment by note and payment by check might give rise to error. As far as Peel's Act was concerned, however, this very shortcoming of the theory that had created it turned out to be an advantage. It caused the incorporation in it of the safety valve, without which it would not have been able to cope with the subsequent increase in the requirements of business. The fundamental mistake of Peel's system, which it shares with all other systems which proceed by restricting the note circulation, lies in its failure to foresee the extension of the quota of notes not backed by metal that went with the increase in the demand for money in the broader sense. As far as the past was concerned, the Act sanctioned the creation of a certain amount of fiduciary media and the influence that this had on the determination of the objective exchange value of money. It did not do anything to counteract the effects of this issue of fiduciary media. But, at the same time, in order to guard the capital market from shocks, it removed all future possibility of partly or wholly satisfying the increasing demand for money by the issuing of fiduciary media, and so of mitigating or entirely preventing a rise in the objective exchange value of money. This amounts to the same thing as suppressing the creation of fiduciary media altogether, and so renouncing all the attendant advantages for the stabilization of the objective exchange value of money. It is an heroic remedy with a vengeance, in essence hardly differing from all the proposals of the downright opponent of all fiduciary media. Nevertheless, something was overlooked in the calculations of the currency theorists. They did not realize that unbacked deposits were substantially the same as unbacked notes, and so they omitted to legislate for them in the same way as for the notes. So far as development of fiduciary media depended on the issue of notes, Peel's Act completely restricted it. So far as it depended on the opening of deposit accounts, it was not interfered with at all. This forced the technique of the English banking system in a direction in which it had already been urged in some degree by the circumstance that the right of note issue in London and its environs was an exclusive privilege of the Bank of England. The deposit system developed at the expense of the note system. From the point of view of the community, this was a matter of indifference because notes and deposits both fulfill the same functions. Thus, Peel's Act did not achieve its aim, or at least not in the degree and manner that its authors had intended. Fiduciary media, suppressed as banknotes, developed in the form of deposits. It is true that German writers on banking held that it was possible to discover a fundamental difference between notes and deposits, but they did not succeed in demonstrating their contention. In fact, they did not really attempt to do so. Nowhere is the inherent weakness of German banking theory more obvious than in connection with this particular question of the note versus the check, which for years has been the central issue of all discussion. Anybody who, like them, had learned from the English banking school that there is no fundamental difference between notes and checks, and was in the constant habit of stressing this, should at least be prepared to supply a detailed proof in support of an assertion that the bank note system represents an earlier and lower stage of development of the credit economy than the deposit bank and the check, with the connected system of the account current, book credit, and clearinghouse. Certainly, reference to England and the United States cannot be accepted as proof of the correctness of this assertion, least of all in the mouth of the decided opponent of the Peel's Act and the restriction of the note issued in general, for it is undeniable that the great importance of the deposit system and the decreasing relative importance of the bank note in Anglo-Saxon countries are the result of that act. The consequence is that the German literature on banking theory is full of almost unbelievable contradictions. The repression of the bank note, as it has occurred in England and in the United States, in different ways and for different reasons, but as a result of the same fundamental ideas, and the corresponding growth in importance of the deposit, and the additional circumstance that the organization of the deposit banks has not attained that soundness that would have enabled it to retain the public confidence during dangerous crises, have led to serious disturbances. In England, as also in the United States, it has repeatedly happened in times of crisis that confidence has been destroyed in those banks that circulate fiduciary media in the form of deposits, while confidence in banknotes has been maintained. The measures by which the consequences which such a collapse of a part of the national business organization would infallibly have involved were avoided are well known. In England, an attempt was made to fill the gap in the circulation, which was due to the lack of large quantities of fiduciary media by the Bank of England, being ready to increase the issue of its own notes. In the United States, where the law made this solution impossible, the clearinghouse certificates served the same purpose. In both countries, attempts to give this device a legislative basis were made. But Lowe's bill was not passed, and even the Aldrich-Vreeland Act in the United States had only a partial success. None of the many systems of limiting the note circulation had proved ultimately capable of interposing an insurmountable obstacle in the way of further creation of fiduciary media. This is equally true of Peel's Act, which completely forbids the new issue of fiduciary media in the shape of notes, and of such bank-of-issue legislation in other states as does leave a certain scope for the augmentation of notes not backed by money. Between the English Act of 1844 and, say, the German Act of 1875, there seems to be a fundamental difference. While the one rigidly fixes, for all time, the quota of the note circulation not backed by metal, the other, inasmuch as it only requires that a certain proportion of the note circulation shall be backed by metal, and puts a tax upon the rest, does make provision within certain limits for its future extension. But everything depends upon the scope that is thus provided for extending the issue of fiduciary media. If it had been wide enough to give free play to the development of the unbacked note circulation, then the German law, and the same is true not only of other laws based on the same principle, for example, the Austrian, but also of those that attempt to limit the circulation of notes in other ways, as, for example, the French, would have fundamentally had different results from the English. Since, in fact, it proved to be too narrow for this, the difference between the two laws is merely one of degree, not one of kind. All these laws have limited the issue of fiduciary media in the form of notes, but have set no limits to their issue in the form of deposits. Making the issue of notes more difficult was bound to promote an increased employment of deposits in place of the note. The deposit account came into prominence. For the development of the credit system, this change was not altogether a matter of indifference. The note is technically superior to the deposit in medium and small transactions. In many cases, for which it might have been used as a money substitute, checks or clearing transfers could not be used, and in such cases restriction of the issue of fiduciary media in the form of notes was bound to have the effect of restriction of the issue of fiduciary media in general. Under the law of the United States of America, the issue of fiduciary media in the shape of deposits is also restricted, but since this only applies to some of the banks, viz. The national banks, it is not enough to make a big difference between the deposit business of the United States and that of the other countries in which no similar regulations have been established. The real obstacle in the way of an unlimited extension of the issue of fiduciary media is not constituted by legislative restrictions of the note issue, which, after all, only affects a certain kind of fiduciary medium, but the lack of a centralized world bank or of uniform procedure on the part of all credit-issuing banks. So long as the banks do not come to an agreement among themselves concerning the extension of credit, the circulation of fiduciary media can indeed be increased slowly, but it cannot be increased in a sweeping fashion. Each individual bank can only make a small step forward, and must, then, wait until the others have followed its example. Every bank is obliged to regulate its interest policy in accordance with that of the others. Section 3. The Nature of Discount Policy. The most obscure and incorrect concepts are current concerning the nature of the discount policy of the central banks of issue. Often the principal task of the banks is said to be the protection of their cash reserves, as if it would pay them to make sacrifices for such an aim as that. No less widespread, however, is the view that the bank's obligation to follow a discount policy that takes account of the circumstances of other banks is imposed upon them merely by a perverse legislation, and that the ideal of cheap money in a double sense, viz. A low purchasing power of money and a low rate of interest, could be realized by the abandonment of certain out-of-date legal provisions. It is unnecessary to devote very much time to the refutation of such views as these. After all that has been said on the nature of money and fiduciary media, there can hardly be very much doubt as to the aim of the discount policy of the banks. Every credit-issuing bank is obliged to fix the rate of interest it charges for loans in certain conformity with that of the other credit-issuing banks. The rate cannot be allowed to sink below this level, for if it did, the sums of money needed by the bank's rapidly extending clientele for making payments to customers of other banks would increase in such a fashion that the bank's solvency would be imperiled. It is by raising the rate of discount that the bank safeguards its own capacity to pay. This end is certainly not attained by protecting the redemption fund, the small insignificance of which for maintaining the value of the fiduciary media has already been demonstrated, but by avoiding the artificial extension of the circulation of fiduciary media that would result from asking less interest than the other banks, and so also avoiding an increase in the demands for the redemption of the fiduciary media. The banks would still have to have a discount policy, even if there were no legislative regulation of the note cover. In Germany, there has been a controversy as to whether certain measures of the Reichsbank are dictated by regard to the circumstances of the domestic money market or to those of the international. In the form in which it is usually put, the question is meaningless. The mobility of capital goods, which nowadays is but little restricted by legislative provisions such as customs duties or by other obstacles, has led to the formation of a homogeneous world capital market. In the loan markets of the countries that take part in international trade, the net rate of interest is no longer determined according to national, but according to international considerations. Its level is settled not by the natural rate of interest in the country, but by the natural rate of interest anywhere. Just as the exchange ratio between money and other economic goods is the same in all places, so also the ratio between the prices of goods of the first order and those of goods of higher orders is the same everywhere. The whole system of modern international trade would be completely changed if the mobility of capital goods were to be restricted. In Germany, there are many who demand such a prohibition, or at least a considerable restriction of the investment of capital abroad. It is not our task to demonstrate what a small prospect of success a policy like this would have, or to show that the time has now passed for a nation to decide whether or not it will take part in international trade. So long and in so far, however, as a nation participates in international trade, its market is only a part of the world market. Prices are determined not nationally, but internationally. The fact that the rate of interest in Germany may rise, not because any change has occurred in its determinants within the Reich, but because there have been changes, say, in the United States, should not seem any more remarkable than, say, a rise in the price of corn that is due to the state of foreign harvests. It has not been easy to reconcile policy with the extension and combination of national markets into a world market. Stronger than the resistance encountered centuries ago by the development of the town economy into the national economy is that which the 19th and 20th centuries have opposed to the further stage of development into a world economy. Nowadays, there is nothing like the feeling of homogeneity which previously overcame regional interests. The pronounced emphasis upon national antagonisms, which sets the keynote of modern policy, would perhaps stand in the way of attempts at economic unification, even if there were no interests to which these attempts might prove injurious. From the point of view of the producer, low prices seem to be the greatest of all evils. And in every state, those producers who are unable to meet competition strive with all the means at their disposal to keep the cheap commodities of the world market out of the national market. But whether they succeed in this in each individual case or not depends to a large extent on the strength of the political influence of the opposing interests. For in the case of every individual commodity, the producer's interest in high prices is opposed by the interest of consumers in the opening of the market to the cheapening effect of foreign competition. The matter is only decided by the conflict of the two groups. The distribution of forces is otherwise when the problem of freedom of capital transactions is under discussion. We have already seen that creditor interests always get the worst of it when they clash with debtor interests. The interests of the capitalist are scarcely ever represented in monetary policy. Nobody ever objects to the importation of capital from abroad on the ground that it leads to a depression of the rate of interest in the home market and a reduction of the income of the capitalists. Quite the reverse. The universally prevailing view is that it is in the interest of the community that the rate of interest should be as low as possible. In those European states with large capital resources, which so far as international dealings in capital are concerned need be considered only as creditors and not as debtors, this policy is expressed in the endeavor to put obstacles in the way of foreign investment. Undoubtedly, this is not the only point of view from which modern states judge the export of capital. Other considerations enter into the matter as well, some in favor of exportation, some against it. There is, for instance, the fact that it is frequently impossible to export commodities except by allowing the payment for them to be postponed so that future goods are acquired in exchange for the present goods surrendered. And that for this reason alone, it is consequently necessary to promote the export of capital, or at least not to hinder it. Nevertheless, it must be insisted that the policy adopted by these states with regard to the export of capital is guided by the endeavor, among others, to keep the domestic rate of interest low. On the other hand, the same motive leads these states, which, because they are poor in capital, have to play the part of international borrowers, to encourage this importation. The attempt to depress the domestic rate of interest by influencing the international movement of capital is particularly pronounced in the so-called money market, i.e., in the market for short-term capital investments. In the so-called capital market, i.e., the market for long-term capital investments, there is less possibility of effecting anything by intervention. In any case, any steps that may be taken become effective much more quickly in the former than in the latter. Consequently, there is a greater propensity toward exerting an influence on the rate of interest on loans in the money market than in the long-term capital market. But the most important cause of the persistence of demands for the exertion of influence upon the money market lies in the universally prevalent errors concerning the nature of fiduciary media and of bank credit. When a relatively small efflux of gold induces the powerful central bank of issue of a rich country to raise the discount rate, there is a tendency to think that there must be some other way than this by which the efflux of gold could be prevented without involving the community in what is regarded as the injurious effect of a rise in the rate of interest. It is not seen that what is happening is the automatic adjustment of the national to the world rate of interest, owing to the way in which the country is involved in international trade. That the country cannot be cut off from participation in international capital dealings simply and solely by measures of banking and currency policy is completely overlooked. This alone can explain how it can come about in large exporting countries that the very persons who demand measures for cheapening credit are those who benefit most from the export trade. If those manufacturers for whom every increase in the rate of discount that can be traced to events abroad is an inducement to plead for a modification of the banking system in the direction of releasing the central bank of issue from its obligation to provide gold for export on demand, would realize that the increase in the rate of interest could be effectively put a stop to only by a suppression of the export of capital and complete exclusion of the country from international trade, then they would soon change their minds. And it seems that the implications have already won some degree of general recognition. Even if the literary treatment of the problem may still leave something to be desired, in Germany and Austria, it was only the groups that demanded the seclusion of the national market that also demanded the isolation of the currency. Further explanation is unnecessary. Nevertheless, it may not be supererogatory to examine one by one the measures that are recommended by those who favor a low rate of interest and to show how incapable they would prove of leading to the expected result. Section 4. The Gold Premium Policy. Let us first review the systems which are supposed to be able to maintain the level of the rate of discount in the national money market by making it more difficult or more expensive to procure gold at a rate below that determined by the circumstances of the international market. The most important and well-known of these is the Gold Premium Policy, as it was carried out by the Bank of France. In view of the circumstances that nowadays the silver 5-franc piece is still legally current coin, the Bank of France is authorized to redeem its notes at its own choice either in gold or in these pieces. It sometimes used to make use of this authority for the purpose of increasing the difficulty of procuring gold for export purposes. As a rule, it made no difficulty about surrendering gold in exchange for notes. And it exchanged 5-franc pieces in the same way for gold coins, although it was not obliged to do so, and by so doing it endowed the latter with the property of being money substitutes. Naturally, these facilities were not requisitioned to a great extent for purposes of domestic business. Notes and 5-franc pieces enjoyed unlimited public confidence, so that their employability as money substitutes was not in the least in question. But if the bank was asked to surrender gold for export, it did not necessarily do so. It is true that it used to hand over gold unhesitatingly for the requirements of what was called legitimate trade, i.e., when it was needed to pay for imported commodities, especially corn and cotton. But if gold was demanded for the purpose of speculating on the difference between home and foreign interest rates, it was not handed over as a matter of course. For this purpose, the bank did not issue Napoleons, the French gold coins, at all, and it issued ingots and foreign gold coins only at an additional charge varying to 4 to 8% of the 3,437 francs at which it was legally bound to purchase a kilogram of fine gold. It is impossible to state the exact amount of this gold premium because the rate has never been published officially. The purpose of the gold premium policy was to postpone, as long as ever possible, the moment when the condition of the international money market would force the bank to raise the discount rate in order to prevent an efflux of gold. The lowness of the rate of discount is of extraordinary importance in French financial policy. In the interest of those classes of the community by which it is supported, the government of the Third Republic is obliged to avoid anything that might injure the high standing of the rentes, which constitute the chief investment of those classes. Even a merely temporary high rate of discount is always dangerous to the rentes market, for it might induce some holders of rentes to dispose of their bonds in order to reinvest their capital more fruitfully, and the disturbance of the market that might result from this would have a disproportionately adverse effect on the quotation of the rentes. It is undeniable that the result aimed at was to a certain extent attained, even though the premium policy by no means possessed the significance that was erroneously ascribed to it. It is above all mistaken to ascribe the lowness of the rate of discount in France to the procedure that has been described. If the rate of discount has been lower in France than in other countries, this is due altogether to different causes. France is of all the countries in the whole world that which is the richest in capital, but its people are not greatly endowed with the spirit of initiative and enterprise. Consequently, its capital has to emigrate. Now, in a country which exports capital, even disregarding the premium for risk-bearing that is contained in the gross rate of interest, the rate of interest on loans must be lower than in a country which imports capital. Capitalists, when comparing the yields of home and foreign investment, are led by a series of psychological factors to prefer the former to the latter, when other circumstances are equal. This is enough to explain why long-term and short-term investments bear lower interest in France than in other countries, such as Germany. The cause is a general economic cause. It is a matter in which measures of banking or currency policy can have no influence. The ratio between the rate of interest in France and that abroad could not for long be forced away by the premium policy of the Bank of France from that determined by the general economic situation. The Bank of France was not above the laws that govern the course of economic affairs. In fixing the level of its discount rate, it was not exempt from the necessity for paying due attention to the level of the natural rate of interest. Like every other credit-issuing bank that has an influence on the domestic market, it had to endeavor to keep the rate of interest on domestic short-term investments at such a level that foreign investment did not appear so attractive to home capitalists as to endanger the bank's own solvency. Like the others, the Bank of France could effectively prevent an outflow of gold in only one way, by raising its discount rate. Employing the premium policy could do no more than postpone for a short time a rise in the rate of discount that the state of the international money market had made necessary. The premium made it more expensive to export gold, and so reduced the profitability of interest arbitrage transactions. When it was widely believed that the difference between the French and the foreign rates of interest was about to be altered in France's favor through a fall in the foreign rate, then arbitrage dealers would not export gold at all, since the small profit of the transaction would be too greatly reduced by the premium. In this way, the Bank of France may sometimes have avoided raising the discount rate when it would otherwise have been necessary to do so for a short time. But whenever the difference between the rates of interest was significant enough to make short-term foreign investments still promise to be profitable in spite of the increased cost of procuring gold due to the premium, and whenever the result of arbitrage dealings was not jeopardized by the prospect of an imminent reduction of the foreign rate, then even the Bank of France could not avoid raising the rate of interest. It has been asserted that it is possible for a central bank to use successive increases of the premium so as entirely to prevent the export of gold if it continually forces back the gold point or export limit as the fall in the rate of exchange requires. This is undoubtedly correct. The procedure, as is well known, has been employed repeatedly. It is known as cessation of cash payments. The bank that adopts it deprives its fiduciary media of their character of money substitutes. If they continue to function as general media of exchange, it is in the role of credit money. Their value will have become subject to independent variation. In such a case, it is admittedly possible for the bank to follow a completely independent discount policy. It may now reduce to any desired extent the rate of interest it charges without running the risk of insolvency. But this brings to light the consequences that must follow a banking policy that endeavors by extending the issue of fiduciary media to depress the rate of interest on loans below the natural rate of interest. This point has already been discussed in detail. In the present connection, there is a second point that is of importance. If the intervention of the bank leads to the artificial retention of the rate of interest on loans at a level below that of the rate given by international conditions, then the capitalist will be all the more anxious to invest their capital abroad as the gap between the domestic and foreign rates of interest increases. The demand for foreign common media of exchange will increase because foreign capital goods will be desired more and home capital goods less. And there is no way in which the fall in the rate of exchange could automatically set forces in motion to reestablish between the bank money and gold, the world money, that exchange ratio which had previously existed when the notes and deposits of the bank were not credit money, but still money substitutes. The mechanism of the monetary system tends to bring the exchange level of the two kinds of money in that natural level determined by the exchange ratio between each of them and the remaining goods. But in the present case, it is the natural exchange ratio itself which has moved against the country that refuses to pay out gold. An autonomous interest policy must necessarily lead to progressive depreciation. There are many advocates of the gold premium policy who make no attempt to deny that its employment in the way in which they intend must infallibly lead to a credit money or fiat money standard with a rapidly falling objective exchange value of the unit. In fact, they are inclined to regard this very fact as a special advantage, for they are, more or less, inflationists. Nevertheless, this was by no means the way in which the Bank of France carried out its premium policy. It observed a fixed limit, above which it never allowed the premium to rise in any circumstances whatever. 8 per mil is probably the highest premium that it has ever demanded. And this was certainly not an error on the part of the bank. It was founded on the nature of the case. In the eyes of the French government and of the administration of the bank controlled by it, the amount of depreciation consequent upon a gold premium of 8% was not intolerable. But in view of the unpredictable reactions throughout the whole community, it was thought better to avoid any further depreciation than this. Thus, the French gold premium policy was not able to prevent the export of gold altogether, but could only postpone it for a short time. Now, this fact alone, and not only when the difference between the rates of interest was so inconsiderable and transient that the rate of discount did not need to be raised at all, meant a cheapening of the rate of interest on loans. But this was offset by the increase in the rate of interest during those periods when the rate of interest abroad was relatively low. Whenever the loan rate abroad sank so low that it might have seemed advantageous to capitalists to transfer capital to France for investment, they nevertheless refrained from doing so if a long continuance of the situation could not be reckoned with, or if the difference between the rates was not very great, because they had reason to fear that a subsequent repatriation of the capital, when the situation was reversed, would be possible only at an increased cost. Thus, the gold premium policy did not merely constitute a hindrance to the efflux of gold from France, it also hindered an influx. It reduced the rate of interest on loans at certain times, but raised it at other times. It is true that it did not altogether exclude the country from international dealings in capital. It only made participation in them harder. But it did this in both directions. Its effect, the intensity of which should not be overestimated, was principally expressed in the fact that the rate of interest for short-term investments has been more stable in France than in other countries. It has never sunk so low as in England, for example, but neither has it ever risen so high. This is shown quite clearly by a comparison of movements in the London and Paris loan rates. It has become more and more clearly recognized that the gold premium policy could not have the effects ascribed to it. Those who once considered it the remedy for all ills are gradually becoming silent. Section 5. Systems Similar to the Gold Premium Policy. The legal provisions which have permitted the Bank of France to follow the gold premium policy were absent in those countries which until recently were on a pure gold standard. Where the gold coins have not been supplemented by any money substitutes, fiat money or credit money with unlimited legal tender by any payer, including the central credit issuing bank, the fiduciary media have had to be redeemed at full face value in money without a premium being charged in addition. But in actual fact, these banks also were tending to adopt a policy different in degree, but certainly not in kind, from the described procedure of the Bank of France. In most countries, the central bank of issue was only obliged to redeem its notes in legal tender gold coins of its own country, after the pattern of English banking law. It is in accordance with the spirit of the modern monetary system and with the ultimate aims of monetary policy that this obligation has been understood also to refer to the surrender of gold ingots to exporters at the legal ratio, or at least at a price that made it more profitable to procure bullion than coins. Thus, until 1889, the Bank of England voluntarily extended its obligation to redeem its notes by paying out on demand, in ingots, the value of the notes in full-weight gold coins. It did this by fixing its selling price for gold bullion once for all at 77 shillings 10½ pence per ounce of standard gold. For a time, the continental banks of issue followed this example, but they soon determined upon a different procedure, and eventually the Bank of England, too, relinquished its old policy and adopted the practice of the continental banks. The Bank of England and the German Reichsbank, apart from the Bank of France, the two most important credit-issuing banks in the world, were in the habit of issuing, for export purposes, worn gold coins only of inferior value. Sovereigns, as issued by the Bank of England for export, were usually from 2 to 3% worse than the newly minted sovereigns. The weight of the 20 mark pieces, received by a person who withdrew gold coins from the German Reichsbank for purposes of exportation, was, according to the calculations of experts, 7.943 grams on an average, as against a standard average of 7.965 grams, i.e. something over 0.25% less than their meant value. The Bank of England sometimes refused altogether to issue gold ingots, and sometimes would only issue them at a price in excess of the 77 shillings 10½ pence, which alone was usual until 1889. it sometimes raised the selling price of ingots to as much as 77 shillings 11 pence. As regards the range and the effect of these measures, nothing need be added to what has already been said about the French gold premium policy. The difference, as has been said, is only quantitative, not qualitative. The other little devices, which have also been employed for making the export of gold more difficult, have their effect in precisely the same fashion. As, for example, when the German Reichsbank sometimes prohibited the issue of gold for export purposes, except in Berlin, by invoking the letter of Section 18 of the Bank Act, which had the effect of making the export of gold more costly by burdening the gold exporters with the risk and cost of transporting the gold from Berlin to the place of export. Section 6. The non-satisfaction of the so-called illegitimate demand for money. In the returns of the Bank of France, it has been repeatedly asserted that the gold premium policy was directed only against those who wished to withdraw gold from the bank for speculative purposes. The bank, it was said, never put difficulties in the way of procuring gold for satisfying the legitimate demands of French trade. No explanation was given of the idea of legitimate demand and its contrary, illegitimate demand. The idea on which this distinction is obviously based is that trade and commodities in dealings in capital are two perfectly distinct and independent branches of economic activity, and that it would be possible to restrict the one without affecting the other. That refusal to surrender gold for arbitrage dealings could not increase the expense of procuring commodities from abroad so long as no difficulty was made about placing at the disposal of the importer the sums needed by him to pay for his purchases. On closer examination, this argument can hardly be accepted as valid. Even if we completely ignore the fact that dealings in capital only constitute one form of the general process of exchange of goods, and consider nothing beyond the technical problem of the withdrawal of gold, it is clear that the bank cannot achieve its aim by discriminatory treatment of different requests for gold. If exportation of gold did not seem profitable because of the difference between the rates of interest, imported raw materials would actually be paid for, partly or wholly, by the commodities exported. The importer would not try to obtain gold from the bank. He would go into the market and buy bills originating in the French export business. If gold were delivered to him by the bank without a premium, while the rate of exchange rose roughly by the amount of, and on account of the premium that was charged to arbitrage dealers, this might well mean a favoring of the import business, and might possibly, in some circumstances, benefit the consumer as well, although that depends entirely on the state of competition among importers. But all the same, the rate of exchange would experience the variation that the bank wished to avoid. The upper gold point would be fixed too high by an amount equal to the amount of the premium. Finally, it must be pointed out that the distinction between a legitimate and an illegitimate demand for gold for export cannot be applied in practice. The demand for gold with which to pay for imported goods may be called legitimate. The demand for gold with which to buy foreign bills as a temporary investment with a view to exploiting a difference in interest rates may be called illegitimate. But there are many remaining intermediate cases which cannot be placed in either one or the other category. Would it have been possible, say, for the Bank of France to put obstacles in the way of the withdrawal of deposits held by foreign states, municipalities, and companies, perhaps as the balances of loans? Or for the Austro-Hungarian Bank, which has repeatedly been accused of refusing to issue bills to persons who intend to carry out arbitrage dealings to increase the difficulty of speculative repurchase of home securities from abroad? Section 7. Other measures for strengthening the stock of metal held by the central banks of issue. The endeavors of the central banks of issue to build up as large gold reserves as possible have led to the employment of devices which have just the opposite appearance to that of the premium policy and the systems similar to it. By raising the price they paid for gold imports, the banks used to try to diminish the cost to the importer of importing gold, and so to reduce the lower gold point. Among these devices was the practice of granting interest-free or low-interest-bearing advances to importers of gold, a practice which was not unknown in England, France, and Germany. There was also the practice of buying gold not only at the chief office, but also at branches situated near the national boundary. Perhaps the most interesting of these devices was that of buying certain kinds of gold coin at a price in excess of their bullion value. If the bank issued to a gold exporter, instead of ingots or coins of the country to which he intended to send the gold, it could get a higher price for them than that corresponding to their gold content. For the exporter would save the expense of melting and recoinage and avoid the loss in which he would be involved by the fact that domestic coins would be worn down to some extent. So the bank would be able to agree to pay a higher price than that corresponding to the metal content for the current gold coins of the states into which the future export of gold was probable. All of these measures can best be described as weapons against the premium policies and related devices employed by foreign banks. If the central bank in country A endeavored to raise the upper gold point for export from A to country B, then the bank in B took steps to lower it. If only used coins were issued for export purposes in A, this procedure was rendered nugatory when a price in excess of the gold content was paid in B for coins of country A. It is very probable that the devices and counter-devices were largely compensatory, so that the extension of the gap between the gold points, which otherwise would necessarily have resulted from the intervention of the banks, did not in fact occur. Section 8. The promotion of check and clearing transactions as a means of reducing the rate of discount. In Germany, where before the war relatively very much gold was in circulation, there was a constantly growing endeavor to withdraw it from circulation by an extension of check and clearing transactions and to divert it into the vaults of the Reichsbank. The aim of this propaganda is set forth in a circular of the elders of the Kaufmannschaft in Berlin, SD, May 2, 1907, to the following effect. The causes to which the high rate of interest in Germany are to be traced are rooted to a large extent in the circumstance that the German people make greater use than those in other countries of cash media of circulation, gold and silver, for payments arising in and out of the course of business, but have not yet sufficiently accustomed themselves to the procedure which might replace the use of gold and silver, and also of banknotes and treasury notes, as media of circulation, viz. The use of checks and the clearing system. If a considerable proportion of payments could be settled by means of transfers from one account to another, or by checks, then this would save large sums of currency in gold and silver, as well as in banknotes, and this saved currency would then accumulate in the reserves of the banks of issue, especially of the central bank of issue, the Reichsbank. The more this happened, the smaller would be the demand for currency that had to be satisfied by the Reichsbank, and the stronger would be the cash reserve of the Reichsbank, which circumstances would contribute considerably toward a reduction of the rate of interest at the Reichsbank and in the whole country. In this is a very clear demonstration of the weakness of theoretical views that underlie modern banking policy. The level of the rate of interest is said to depend on the demand for currency. The strengthening of the cash reserve of the central bank of issue is credited with the effect of reducing the rate of interest in the whole country, and of reducing it appreciably. And this is not just the opinion of some private person or other, but that of the highly respected corporation of the Berlin Kaufmannschaft. And also, as everyone knows, that of the leaders of German economic policy in general. On this one point, all parties seem to be agreed. However, much of their views on the nature of economic phenomena may otherwise diverge. But even if this fundamental error is for a moment disregarded, it is impossible to overlook the weakness of the doctrines expounded, and above all, their contradictoriness. The proportion of cover for the Reichsbank notes, provided for in the banking legislation of the 70s, is treated as sacrosanct. The possibility of changing these provisions by substituting, say, the cover of 1/4 or 1/5 for that of 1/3 is never contemplated. The letter of the law has to be preserved while the assumptions on which it was based are being altered. When money substitutes, in the form of deposits, are augmented without provision being made for a monetary cover, the quantity of fiduciary media is increased. This is further demonstrative of the fact that even that part of the argument of the banking principle which was theoretically correct was unable to exert any influence on practical politics. Tuke and Fullerton repeatedly point out that there is no fundamental difference between notes and deposits, which they speak of as checks. Their modern successors do not dare to draw the logical conclusion from this incontrovertible fact. They stand for the differential treatment of fiduciary media according to whether they are notes or deposits. If part of the gold in circulation in Germany and part of the banknotes had been replaced by fiduciary media in the shape of deposits, this might have led to a diminution in the rate of interest only insofar as the gold that had become superfluous was employed for obtaining capital goods from abroad. The replacement of notes without a metal backing by deposits without a metal backing is of no consequence in this connection. Only so far as notes covered by metal were replaced by deposits not covered by metal would there be any increase in the circulation of fiduciary media at the expense of that of the money certificates by which gold would be released for export to other countries. But the same result could have been attained by a diminution of the ratio between cover and banknotes. Nevertheless, this simpler device was generally held to be impracticable, in spite of the fact that it was precisely as safe or precisely as dangerous as the other. If the gold dispensed with in this way had been exported, then the stock of other economic goods at the disposal of the German nation would have increased correspondingly. This might have led to a fall, if only a trifling one, in the rate of interest, assuming that the quantity of gold expelled from Germany was absorbed abroad with a general fall in the objective exchange value of money. But the German champions of an extension of the check and clearing system did not think of that when making proposals of this sort. They recommended the extension of the circulation of fiduciary media in the form of deposits because they believed that this would reduce the number and extent of those applications that made demands upon the credit that the Reichsbank granted in the form of notes, and they hoped that this would lead to a reduction in the rate of interest on loans. There is a serious error in all this. The level of the rate of interest on loans does not depend on the amount of the national stock of money in the wider sense, nor, of course, on the amount of fiduciary media in circulation. It was not the legal regulations concerning cover that forced the Reichsbank to aim at a discount policy that would prevent any tension from arising between the natural rate of interest and the discount rate, but its inevitable concern for its own solvency. In all those countries whose credit system is organized on the so-called single reserve basis, so that the stock of money needed for the redemption on demand of money substitutes is administered by a central bank, on which, in times of emergency, all the credit-issuing banks must ultimately fall back, it is the directors of this bank who are the first to notice the outward flow of gold, and it is they who must be the first to take steps to stop it, since its first effects are directed against the institution for which they are responsible. Therefore, the raising of the discount rate by the central bank usually precedes the increased severity of lending terms in the open market and in the dealings between the private banks and their clients. And so superficial critics jump to the conclusion post hoc ergo propter hoc. Nothing could be more mistaken. Even quite apart from the proceedings of the central bank of issue, the private banks and others who issue money have to adjust their interest policy to the rate of interest ruling in the world market. Sums could be withdrawn from them for the purposes of interest arbitrage, just as from the central bank. In fact, so long as the mobility of capital is not restricted, it remains impossible for the credit-issuing banks of any single country to follow an independent credit policy. 3. Problems of credit policy in the period immediately after the war. Section 9. The Gold Exchange Standard. Wherever inflation has thrown the monetary system into confusion, the primary aim of currency policy has been to bring the printing presses to a standstill. Once that is done, once it has at last been learned that even the policy of raising the objective exchange value of money has undesirable consequences, and once it is seen that the chief thing is to stabilize the value of money, then attempts are made to establish a gold exchange standard as quickly as possible. This, for example, is what occurred in Austria at the end of 1922, and since then, at least for the time being, the dollar rate in that country has been fixed. But in existing circumstances, invariability of the dollar rate means invariability of the price of gold also. Thus, Austria has a dollar exchange standard, and so, indirectly, a gold exchange standard. That is, the currency system that seems to be the immediate aim in Germany, Poland, Hungary, and many other European countries. Nowadays, European aspirations in the sphere of currency policy are limited to a return to the gold standard. This is quite understandable, for the gold standard previously functioned on the whole satisfactorily. It is true that it did not secure the unattainable ideal of a money with an invariable objective exchange value, but it did preserve the monetary system from the influence of governments and changing policies. Yet the gold standard system was already undermined before the war. The first step was the abolition of the physical use of gold in individual payments and the accumulation of the stocks of gold in the vaults of the great banks of issue. The next step was the adoption of the practice by a series of states of holding the gold reserves of the central banks of issue, or the redemption funds that took their place, not in actual gold, but in various sorts of foreign claims to gold. Thus, it came about that the greater part of the stock of gold that was used for monetary purposes was gradually accumulated in a few large banks of issue, and so these banks became central reserve banks of the world. As previously, the central banks of issue had become central reserve banks for individual countries. The war did not create this development. It merely hastened it a little. Neither has the development yet reached the stage when all the newly produced gold that is not absorbed into individual use flows to a single center. The Bank of England and the central banks of issue of some other states still control large stocks of gold. There are still several of them that take up part of the annual output of gold. Yet fluctuations in the price of gold are nowadays essentially dependent on the policy followed by the Federal Reserve Board. If the United States did not absorb gold to the extent to which it does, the price of gold would fall and the gold prices of commodities would rise. Since, so long as the dollar represents a fixed quantity of gold, the United States admits the surplus of gold and surrenders commodities for gold to an unlimited extent. A rapid fall in the value of gold has hitherto been avoided. But this policy of the United States, which involves considerable sacrifices, might one day be changed. Variations in the price of gold would then occur, and this would be bound to give rise in other gold countries to the question of whether it would not be better, in order to avoid further rises in prices, to dissociate the currency standard from gold. Just as Sweden attempted for a time to raise the krona above its old gold parity by closing the mint to gold, So other countries that are now still on the gold standard, or intend to return to it, might act similarly. This would mean a further drop in the price of gold and a further reduction of the usefulness of gold for monetary purposes. If we disregard the Asiatic demand for money, we might even now, without undue exaggeration, say that gold has ceased to be a commodity, the fluctuations in the price of which are independent of government influence. Fluctuations in the price of gold are nowadays substantially dependent on the behavior of one government, viz., that of the United States of America. All that could not have been foreseen in this result of a long process of development is the circumstance that the fluctuations in the price of gold should have become dependent upon the policy of one government only. That the United States should have achieved such an economic predominance over other countries as it now has, and that it alone of all countries of great economic importance should have retained the gold standard, while the others, England, France, Germany, Russia, and the rest, have at least temporarily abandoned it. That is a consequence of what took place during the war. Yet the matter would not be essentially different if the price of gold was dependent not on the policy of the United States alone, but on those of four or five other governments as well. Those protagonists of the gold exchange standard who have recommended it as a general monetary system and not merely as an expedient for poor countries have overlooked this fact. They have not observed that the gold exchange standard must at least mean depriving gold of that characteristic which is the most important from the point of view of monetary policy, its independence of government influence upon fluctuations in its value. The gold exchange standard has not been recommended or adopted with the object of dethroning gold. All that Ricardo wanted was to reduce the cost of the monetary system. In many countries which, from the last decade of the 19th century onward, have wished to abandon the silver or credit money standard, the gold exchange standard, rather than a gold standard with an actual gold currency, has been adopted in order to prevent the growth of a new demand for gold from causing a rise in its price and a fall in the gold prices of commodities. But whatever the motives may have been by which the protagonists of the gold exchange standard have been led, there can be no doubt concerning the results of its increasing popularity. If the gold exchange standard is retained, the question must sooner or later arise as to whether it would not be better to substitute for it a credit money standard whose fluctuations were more susceptible to control than those of gold. For if fluctuations in the price of gold are substantially dependent on political intervention, it is inconceivable why government policy should still be restricted at all and not given a free hand altogether, since the amount of this restriction is not enough to confine arbitrariness in price policy within narrow limits. The cost of additional gold for monetary purposes that is borne by the whole world might well be saved, for it no longer secures the result of making the monetary system independent of government intervention. If this complete government control is not desired, there remains one alternative only. An attempt must be made to get back from the gold exchange standard to the actual use of gold again. Section 10. A Return to a Gold Currency. A return to the actual use of gold would be certain to have effects that would scarcely be welcomed. It would lead to a rise in the price of gold, or, what is the same thing, to a fall in the price of commodities. The fact that this is not generally desired, and the reason why it is not, have already been dealt with. We may confidently suppose that such a fall in prices would cause just as much dissatisfaction as was caused by the process of expelling gold from circulation, and it hardly demands an excessive amount of insight to be able to predict that in such circumstances it would not be long before the gold standard was again accused of responsibility for the bad state of business. Once again, the gold standard would be reproached with depressing prices and forcing up the rate of interest, and once again proposals would be made for some sort of modification of the gold standard. In spite of all these objections, the question of the advisability of a return to an actual gold standard demands serious consideration. One thing alone would recommend the abandonment of the gold exchange standard and the reintroduction of the actual use of gold. This is the necessity for making a recurrence of inflationary policies, if not impossible, at least substantially more difficult. From the end of the last century onwards, it was the aim of étatism in monetary policy to restrict the actual circulation of gold for three reasons. First, because it wished to inflate without repealing the existing banking laws by concentrating gold reserves in the central bank of issue. Second, because it wished to accumulate a war chest. And third, because it wished to wean the people from the use of gold coins so as to pave the way for the inflationary policy of the coming Great War. Admittedly, it will not be possible to prevent either war or inflation by opposing such endeavors as these. Kant's proposal to prohibit the raising of loans for war purposes is extremely naive, and it would be still more naive to bring within the scope of such a prohibition the issue of fiduciary media, too. Only one thing can conquer war: that liberal attitude of mind which can see nothing in war but destruction and annihilation, and which can never wish to bring about a war because it regards war as injurious even to the victors. Where liberalism prevails, there will never be war. But where there are other opinions concerning the profitability and injuriousness of war, no rules and regulations, however cunningly devised, can make war impossible. If war is regarded as advantageous, then laws regulating the monetary systems will not be allowed to stand in the way of going to war. On the first day of any war, all the laws opposing obstacles to it will be swept aside, just as in 1914 the monetary legislation of all the belligerent states was turned upside down without one word of protest being ventured. To try to oppose future war policies through currency legislation would be foolish. But it may nevertheless be conceded that the argument in favor of making war more difficult cannot be neglected when the question is being debated of whether the actual domestic circulation of gold should be done away with in the future or not. If the people are accustomed to the actual use of gold in their daily affairs, they will resist an inflationary policy more strongly than did the peoples of Europe in 1914. It will not be so easy for governments to disavow the reactions of war on the monetary system. They will be obliged to justify their policy. The maintenance of an actual gold currency would impose considerable cost on individual nations and would, at first, lead to a general fall of prices. There can hardly be any doubt about that. But all its disadvantages must be accepted as part of the bargain if other services are demanded of the monetary system than that of preparing for war, revolution, and destruction. It is from this point of view that we should approach the question of the denominations of notes. If the issue of notes which do not make up a multiple of at least the smallest gold coins is prohibited, then in the business of everyday life gold coins will have to be used. This could best be brought about by an international currency agreement. It would be easy to force countries into such an agreement by means of penal customs duties. Section 11. The Problem of the Freedom of the Banks. The events of recent years reopen questions that have long been regarded as closed. The question of the freedom of the banks is one of these. It is no longer possible to consider it completely settled, as it must have been considered for decades now. Unfortunate experiences with banknotes that had become valueless because they were no longer actually redeemable led once to the restriction of the right of note issue to a few privileged institutions. Yet experience of state regulation of banks of issue has been incomparably more unfavorable than experience of uncontrolled private enterprise. What do all the failures of banks of issue and clearing banks known to history matter in comparison with the complete collapse of the banking system in Germany? Everything that has been said in favor of control of the banking system pales into insignificance beside the objections that can nowadays be advanced against state regulation of the issue of notes. The etatistic arguments that were once brought forward against the freedom of the note issue no longer carry conviction. In the sphere of banking, as everywhere else, etatism has been a failure. The safeguards erected by the liberal legislation of the 19th century to protect the bank of issue system against abuse by the state have proved inadequate. Nothing has been easier than to treat with contempt all the legislative provisions for the protection of the monetary standard. All governments, even the weakest and most incapable, have managed it without difficulty. Their banking policies have enabled them to bring about the state of affairs that the gold standard was designed to prevent: subjection of the value of money to the influence of political forces. And having arrogated this power to themselves, the governments have put it to the worst conceivable use. But so long as the other political and ideological factors were what they were, we cannot conclude that the mere freedom of the banks would or could have made things different. Let us suppose that freedom of banking had prevailed throughout Europe during the last two generations before the outbreak of World War, that banknotes had not become legal tender, that notes were always examined, not only with respect to their genuineness, but also with respect to their soundness, whenever they were tendered, and those issued by unknown banks rejected, but that the notes of large and well-known banking firms nevertheless were just as freely current as the notes of the great central banks of issue in the period when they were not legal tender. Let us further suppose that since there was no danger of a world banking cartel, the banks had been prevented, by the mere necessity for redeeming their notes in cash, from making immoderate endeavors to extend their issue by charging a low rate of interest, or at least that the risk of this was no greater than under legislative regulation of the note system. Let us suppose, in short, that up to the outbreak of the war, the system had worked no better and no worse than that which actually existed. But the question at issue is whether it would have held its own any better after July 28, 1914. The answer to this question seems to be that it would not have done so. The governments of the belligerent and neutral states overthrew the whole system of bank legislation with a stroke of a pen, and they could have done just the same if the banks had been uncontrolled. There would have been no necessity at all for them to proceed to issue treasury notes. They could simply have imposed on the banks the obligation to grant loans to the state and enabled them to fulfill this obligation by suspending their obligation to redeem their notes and making the notes legal tender. The solution of a few minor technical problems would have been different, but the effect would have been the same. For what enabled the governments to destroy the banking system was not any technical, juristic, or economic shortcoming of the banking organization, but the power conferred on them by the general sentiment in favor of etatism and war. They were able to dominate the monetary system because public opinion gave them the moral right to do so. Necessity knows no law was the principle which served as an excuse for all the actions of all governments alike, and not only that of Germany, which was much blamed because of the candor with which it confessed its adherence to the maxim. At the most, as has been explained, an effective, if limited, protection against future etatistic abuse of the banking system might be secured by prohibiting the issue of notes of small denominations, that is to say, not by uncontrolled private enterprise in banking, but on the contrary by interference with the freedom of the note issue. Apart from this single prohibition, it would be quite possible to leave the note issue without any legislative restrictions and, of course, without any legislative privileges either, such as the granting of legal tender to the notes. Nevertheless, it is clear that banking freedom, per se, cannot be said to make a return to gross inflationary policy impossible. Apart from the question of financial preparation for war, The arguments urged in favor of centralization, monopolization, and state control of banks of issue in general, and of credit-issuing banks in particular, are thoroughly unsound. During the past 20 or 30 years, the literature of banking has gotten so thoroughly lost among the details of commercial technique, has so entirely abandoned the economic point of view, and so completely surrendered itself to the influence of the most undisguised kinds of etatistic argument, that in order to discover what the considerations are that are supposed to militate against the freedom of the banks, it is necessary to go back to the ideas that dominated the banking literature and policy of two or three generations ago. The bank of issue system was then supposed to be regulated in the interests of the poor and ignorant man in the street, so that bank failures might not inflict loss upon those who were unskilled and unpracticed in business matters, the laborer, the salaried employee, the civil servant, the farmer. The argument was that such private persons should not be obliged to accept notes whose value they were unable to test, an argument which only needs to be stated for its utter invalidity to the apparent. No banking policy could have been more injurious to the small man than recent etatism has been. The argument, however, that was then supposed to be the decisive one was provided by the currency principle. From the point of view of this doctrine, any note issue that is not covered by gold is dangerous, and so, in order to obviate the recurrence of economic crises, such issues must be restricted. On the question of theoretical importance of the currency principle, and on the question of whether the means proposed by the currency school were effective, or could have been effective, or might still be effective, there is nothing that need be added to what has been said already. We have already shown that the dangers envisaged by the currency principle exist only when there is uniform procedure on the part of all the credit-issuing banks, not merely within a given country, but throughout the world. Now, the monopolization of the banks of issue in each separate country does not merely fail to oppose any hindrance to this uniformity of procedure, it materially facilitates it. What was supposed to be the decisive argument against freedom of banking in the last generation before the war is just the opposite to that which was held by the currency school. Before the war, state control of banking was desired with the very object of artificially depressing the domestic rate of interest below the level that considerations of the possibility of redemption would have dictated if the banks had been completely free. The attempt was made to render as nugatory as possible the obligations of cash redemption, which constitutes the foundation stone of all credit-issuing bank systems. This was the intention of all the little expedients, individually unimportant but cumulatively of definite if temporary effect, which was then customary to call banking policy. Their one intent may be summed up in the sentence, by hook or by crook, to keep the rate of discount down. They have achieved the circumvention of all the natural and legal obstacles that hinder the reduction of the bank rate below the natural rate of interest. In fact, the object of all banking policy has been to escape the necessity for discount policy, an object, it is true, which it was unable to achieve until the outbreak of the war left the way free for inflation. If the arguments for and against state regulation of the bank of issue system and of the whole system of fiduciary media are examined without the etatistic prejudice in favor of rules and prohibitions, they can lead to no other conclusion than that of one of the last of the defenders of banking freedom. There is only one danger that is peculiar to the issue of notes, that of its being released from the common law obligation under which everybody who enters into a commitment is strictly required to fulfill it at all times and in all places. This danger is infinitely greater and more threatening under a system of monopoly. Section 12. Fisher's Proposal for a Commodity Standard. The more the view regains ground that general business fluctuations are to be explained by reference to the credit policy of the banks, the more eagerly are ways sought for by which to eliminate the alteration of boom and depression in economic life. It was the aim of the currency school to prevent the periodical recurrence of general economic crises by setting a maximum limit to the issue of uncovered banknotes. An obvious further step is to close the gap that was not reckoned with in their theory, and consequently not provided for in their policy, by limiting the issue of fiduciary media in whatever form, not merely that of banknotes. If this were done, it would no longer be possible for the credit-issuing banks to underbid the equilibrium rate of interest and introduce into circulation new quantities of fiduciary media with the immediate consequence of an artificial stimulus to business and the inevitable final consequence of the dreaded economic crisis. Whether a decisive step such as this will actually be taken apparently depends upon the kind of credit policy that is followed in the immediate future by the banks in general and by the big central banks of issue in particular. It has already been shown that it is impossible for a single bank by itself, and even for all banks in a given country, or for all banks in several countries, to increase the issue of fiduciary media, if the other banks do not do the same. The fact that tacit agreement to this effect among all the credit-issuing banks of the world has been achieved only with difficulty, and even at that has only affected what is, after all, but a small increase of credit, has constituted the most effective protection in recent times against excesses of credit policy. In this respect, we cannot yet know how circumstances will shape. If it should prove easier now for the credit-issuing banks to extend their circulation, then failure to adopt measures for limiting the issue of fiduciary media will involve the greatest danger to the stability of economic life. During the years immediately preceding the World War, the objective exchange value of gold fell continuously. From 1896 onwards, the commodity price level rose continuously. This movement, which is to be explained on the one hand by the increased production of gold, and on the other hand by the extended employment of fiduciary media, became still more pronounced after the outbreak of the war. Gold disappeared from circulation in a series of populous countries and flowed into the diminishing region within which it continued to perform a monetary function, as before. Of course, this resulted in a decrease in the purchasing power of gold. Prices rose, not only in the countries with an inflated currency, but also in the countries that had remained on the gold standard. If the countries that nowadays have a paper currency should return to gold, the objective exchange value of gold would rise. The gold prices of commodities and services would fall. This effect might be modified if the gold exchange variety of standard were adopted instead of a gold currency. But if the area within which gold is employed as money is to be extended again, it is a consequence that can hardly be eliminated altogether. It would only come to stop when all countries had again adopted the gold standard. Then, perhaps, the fall in the value of gold, which lasted for nearly 30 years, might set in again. The prospect is not a particularly pleasant one. It is hardly surprising, in the circumstances, that the attention of theorists and politicians should have been directed with special interest to the proposal that aims at nothing less than the creation of a money with the most stable purchasing power possible. The fundamental idea of Fisher's scheme for stabilizing the purchasing power of money is the replacement of the gold standard by a commodity standard. Previous proposals concerning the commodity standard have conceived it as supplementing the precious metal standard. Their intention has been that monetary obligations which did not fall due until after a certain period of time should be dischargeable by virtue either of general compulsory legislation or of special contractual agreements between the parties, not in the nominal sum of money to which they referred, but by payment of that sum of money whose purchasing power at the time when the liability was discharged was equal to the purchasing power of the borrowed sum of money at the time when the liability was incurred. Otherwise, they have intended that the precious metal should still fulfill its monetary office. The tabular standard was to have effect only as a standard of deferred payments. But Fisher has more ambitious designs. His commodity standard is not intended merely to supplement the gold standard, but to replace it altogether. This end is to be attained by means of an ingenious combination of the fundamental concept of the gold exchange standard with that of the tabular standard. The money substitutes that are current under a gold exchange standard are redeemable either in gold or in bills on countries that are on the gold standard. Fisher wishes to retain redemption in gold, but in such a way that the currency units are no longer to be converted into a fixed weight of gold, but into the quantity of gold that corresponds to the purchasing power of the monetary unit at the time of the inauguration of the scheme. The dollar, according to the model bill worked out by Fisher for the United States, ceases to be a fixed quantity of gold of variable purchasing power and becomes a variable quantity of gold of invariable purchasing power. Calculations based on price statistics are used month by month for the construction of an index number, which indicates by how much the purchasing power of the dollar has risen or fallen in comparison with the preceding month. Then, in accordance with this change in the value of money, the quantity of gold that represents $1 is increased or diminished. This is the quantity of gold for which the dollar is to be redeemed at the banks entrusted with this function, and this is the quantity of gold for which they have to pay out $1 to anyone who demands it. Fisher's plan is ambitious, and yet simple. Perhaps it is unnecessary to state that it is in no way dependent upon Fisher's particular theory of money, whose inadequacy as regards certain crucial matter has already been indicated. There is no need to criticize Fisher's scheme again with reference to the considerable dubiety attaching to the scientific correctness of index numbers and to the possibility of turning them to practical account in eliminating those unintended modifications of long-term contracts that arise from variations in the value of money. In Fisher's scheme, the function of the index number is to serve as an indicator of variations in the purchasing power of the monetary unit from month to month. We may suppose that, for determining changes in the value of money over very short periods and in the present connection, the month may certainly be regarded as a very short period. Index numbers could be employed with at least sufficient exactitude for practical purposes. Yet, even if we assume this, we shall still be forced to conclude that the execution of Fisher's scheme could not in any way ameliorate the social consequences of variations in the value of money. But before we enter upon this discussion, it is pertinent to inquire what demands the proposal makes concerning business practice. If it is believed that the effects of variations in the value of money on long-term credit transactions are compensated by variations in the rate of interest, then the adoption of a commodity standard based on the use of index numbers as a supplement to the gold standard must be regarded as superfluous. But, in any case, this is certainly not true of gradual variations in the value of money, of which neither the extent nor even the direction can be foreseen. The depreciation of gold, which has gone on since towards the end of the 19th century, has hardly found any expression at all in variations in the rate of interest. Thus, if it were possible to find a satisfactory solution of the problem of measuring variations in the value of money, the adoption of a tabular standard for long-term credit transactions, the decision as to the employment of the index being left to the parties to each particular contract, could by no means be regarded as superfluous. But the technical difficulties in the way are too great as to be insurmountable. The scientific inadequacy of all methods of calculating index numbers means that there can be no correct one, and therefore none that could command general recognition. The choice among the many possible methods, which are all equally inadequate from the purely theoretical point of view, is an arbitrary one. Now, since each method will yield a different result, the opinions of debtors and creditors concerning them will differ also. The different solutions adopted in the law, or by administrative authority responsible for calculating the index numbers, as the various problems arise, will constitute a new source of uncertainty in long-term credit transactions, an uncertainty that might affect the foundations of credit transactions more than variations in the value of gold would. All this would be true of Fisher's proposals also insofar as they concern long-term credit transactions. Insofar as they concern short-term credit transactions, it must be pointed out that even under the present organization of the monetary system, future fluctuations of the value of money are not ignored. The difficulty about taking account of future variations in the value of money in long-term credit transactions lies in the impossibility of foreknowing the direction and extent of long-period variations even with only relative certainty. But for shorter periods, over weeks, and even over periods of a few months, it is possible to a certain extent to foretell the movement of the commodity price level. And this movement consequently is allowed for in all transactions involving short-term credit. The money market rate of interest, as the rate of interest in the market for short-term investments is called, expresses, among other things, the opinion of the business world as to imminent variations in commodity prices. It rises with the expectation of a rise in prices and falls with the expectation of a fall in prices. In those commercial agreements in which interest is explicitly allowed for, there would be no particular difficulty under Fisher's scheme in making the necessary adjustment of business technique. The only adjustment that would be necessary in the new circumstances would be to leave out of account all considerations of variations in the commodity price level in future calculations of the rate of interest. But the matter is somewhat more complicated in those transactions in which an explicit rate of interest does not appear, but is allowed for implicitly in some other terms of the agreement. An example of a case of purchase on credit will assist in the discussion of this point. Let us assume that in such a case the index number, over a period of 5 successive months, rises each month in arithmetical progression by 1% of the index number proper to the first month. A person who had bought commodities in February on 3 months' credit would have to pay back in May 0.048 of a gram of fine gold for every dollar over and above the gold content of the dollars in which he had made the bargain. Now, according to present practice, the terms of the transactions entered into in February would make allowances for the expected general rise of prices. In the purchase, then determine the views held by the buyer and the seller as to immediate probabilities concerning future prices would already be expressed. Now, since under Fisher's plan the purchase price would still have to be settled by payment of the agreed number of dollars, this rise of prices would be allowed for a second time. Clearly, this will not do. In other words, the present ordinary practice concerning purchases on credit and other credit transactions must be modified. All that a person will have to do after the introduction of the commodity standard, who would have bought a commodity in January on 3 months' credit at $105 under a simple gold standard, is to take account of the expected fluctuations in the value of gold in a different way, in order not to buy dearer than he would have bought in gold dollars. If he correctly foresees these fluctuations as amounting to $3, then he would have to agree to pay a purchase price of only 160 times 105 line over 164.8 dollars equals $101.94. Fisher's project makes a different technique necessary in business. It cannot be claimed that this technique would be any simpler than that used under the pure gold standard. Both with and without Fisher's plan, it is necessary for buyers and sellers to allow for variations in the general level of prices, as well as for the particular variations in the prices of the commodities in which they deal. The only difference is in the method by which they evaluate the result of their speculative opinion. We can thus see what value Fisher's scheme has as far as the consequences of variations in the value of money arising in connection with credit transactions are concerned. For long-term credit transactions, in which Fisher's scheme is no advance on the old and oft-discussed tabular standard, which has never been put into execution because of its disadvantages, the use of the commodity standard as a supplement to the gold standard is impractical because of the fundamental inadequacy of all methods of calculating index numbers. For short-term credit transactions, in which variations in the value of money are already taken account of in a different way, it is superfluous. But variations in the objective exchange value of money have another kind of social consequence, arising from the fact that they are not expressed simultaneously and uniformly with regard to all commodities and services. Fisher's scheme promises no relief at all from consequences of this sort. Fisher, indeed, never refers to this kind of consequence of variations in the value of money and seems to be aware only of such effects as arise from their reactions on debt relationships contracted in terms of money. However it may be calculated, an index number expresses nothing but an average of price variations. There will be prices that change more and prices that change less than the calculated average amount, and there will even be prices that change in the opposite direction. All who deal in those commodities whose prices change differently from the average will be affected by variations in the objective exchange value of gold in the way already referred to in Part 2, Chapter 6, Sections 3 and 4. And the adjustment of the value of the dollar to the average movement of commodity prices as expressed in the chosen index number will be quite unable to affect this. When the value of gold falls, there will be persons who are favored by the fact that the rise in prices begins earlier for the commodities that they sell than for the commodities that they have to buy. And on the other hand, there will be persons whose interests suffer because of the fact that they must continue to sell the commodities in which they deal at the lower price corresponding to earlier circumstances, although they already have to buy at the higher price. Even the execution of Fisher's proposal could not cause the variations in the value of money to occur simultaneously and uniformly in relation to all other economic goods. Thus, the social consequences of variations in the value of money could not be done away with even with the help of Fisher's commodity standard. Section 13. The Basic Questions of Future Currency Policy. Irving Fisher's scheme is symptomatic of a tendency in contemporary currency policy which is antipathetic to gold. There is an inclination in the United States and in Anglo-Saxon countries generally to overestimate in a quite extraordinary manner the significance of index methods. In these countries, it is entirely overlooked that the scientific exactness of these methods leaves much to be desired, that they can never yield anything more than a rough result at best, and that the question whether one or other method of calculation is preferable can never be solved by scientific means. The question of which method is preferred is always a matter for political judgment. It is a serious matter to fall into to imagine that the methods suggested by monetary theorists and currency statisticians can yield unequivocal results that will render the determination of the value of money independent of the political decisions of the governing parties. A monetary system in which variations in the value of money and commodity prices are controlled by the figure calculated from price statistics is not the slightest degree less dependent upon government influences than any other sort of monetary system in which the government is able to exert an influence on values. There can be no doubt that the present state of the market for gold makes a decision between two possibilities imperative: a return to the actual use of gold after the fashion of the English gold standard of the 19th century, or a transition to a fiat money standard with purchasing power regulated according to index numbers. The gold exchange standard might be considered as a possible basis for future currency systems, only if an international agreement could impose upon each state the obligation to maintain a stock of gold of a size corresponding to its capacity. A gold exchange standard with a redemption fund chiefly invested in foreign bills in gold currencies is, in the long run, not a practicable general solution of the problem. The first German edition of this work, published in 1912, concluded with an attempt at a glimpse into the future history of money and credit. The important parts of its argument ran as follows. It has gradually become recognized as a fundamental principle of monetary policy that intervention must be avoided as far as possible. Fiduciary media are scarcely different in nature from money. A supply of them affects the market in the same way as a supply of money proper. Variations in their quantity influence the objective exchange value of money in just the same way as do variations in the quantity of money proper. Hence, they should logically be subjected to the same principles that have been established with regard to money proper. The same attempts should be made in their case as well to eliminate as far as possible human influences on the exchange ratio between money and other economic goods. The possibility of causing temporary fluctuations in the exchange ratios between goods of higher and lower orders by the issue of fiduciary media, and the pernicious consequences connected with a divergence between the natural and money rates of interest, are circumstances leading to the same conclusion. Now, it is obvious that the only way of eliminating human influence on the credit system is to suppress all further issue of fiduciary media. The basic concept of Peel's Act ought to be restated and more completely implemented than it was in the England of his time by including the issue of credit in the form of bank balances within the legislative prohibition. At first, it might appear as if the execution of such radical measures would be bound to lead to a rise in the objective exchange value of money. But this is not necessarily the case. It is not improbable that the production of gold and the increase in the issue of bank credit are at present increasing considerably faster than the demand for money and are consequently leading to a steady diminution of the objective exchange value of money. And there can be no doubt that a similar result follows from the apparently one-sided fixing of prices by sellers, the effect of which in diminishing the value of money has already been examined in detail. The complaints about the general increase in the cost of living, which will continue for a long time yet, may serve as a confirmation of the correctness of this assumption, which can be neither confirmed nor refuted statistically. Thus, a restriction of the growth of the stock of money in the broader sense need not unconditionally lead to a rise in the purchasing power of the monetary unit. It is possible that it might have the effect of completely or partly counteracting the fall in the value of money which might otherwise have occurred. It is not entirely out of the question that the monetary and credit policy of the future will attempt to check any further fall in the objective exchange value of money. Large classes of the population, wage and salary earners, feel that the continuous fall in the value of money is unjust. It is most certain that any proposals that promise them any relief in this direction will receive their warmest support. What these proposals will be like and how far they will go are matters that it is difficult to foresee. In any case, economists are not called upon to act as prophets. Elsewhere in the course of the argument, it was claimed that it would be useless to try and impose the monetary system at all in the way envisaged by the tabular standard. We must abandon all attempts to render the organization of the market even more perfect than it is and content ourselves with what has been attained already, or rather, we must strive to retain what has been attained already. And that is not such an easy matter as it seems to appear to those who have been more concerned to improve the apparatus of exchange than to note the dangers that implied its maintenance at its present level of perfection. It would be a mistake to assume that the modern organization of exchange is bound to continue to exist. it carries within itself the germ of its own destruction. The development of the fiduciary medium must necessarily lead to its breakdown. Once common principles for their circulation credit policy are agreed to by the different credit-issuing banks, or once the multiplicity of credit-issuing banks is replaced by a single world bank, there will be no longer any limit to the issue of fiduciary media. At first, it will be possible to increase the issue of fiduciary media only until the objective exchange value of money is depressed to the level determined by the other possible uses of the monetary metal. But in the case of fiat money and credit money, there is no such limit, and even in the case of commodity money, it cannot prove impassable. For once the employment of money substitutes has superseded the employment of money for actual employment in exchange transactions mediated by money, and we are by no means very far from this state of affairs, the moment the limit was passed, the obligation to redeem the money substitutes would be removed, and so the transition to the bank credit money would easily be completed. Then the only limit to the issue would be constituted by the technical costs of the banking business. In any case, long before these limits are reached, the consequences of the increase in the issue of fiduciary media will make themselves felt acutely. Since then, we have experienced the collapse, sudden enough, of the monetary systems in a whole series of European states. The inflation of the war and post-war periods, exceeding everything that could have been foreseen, has created an unexampled chaos. Now we are on the way to mastering this chaos and to returning to a new organization of the monetary system, which will be all the better the less it differs from the system in force before the war. The organization of exchange that will thus be achieved again will exhibit all the shortcomings that have continually been referred to with emphasis throughout the present book. It will be a task for the future to erect safeguards against the inflationary misuse of the monetary system by the government and against the extension of the circulation of fiduciary media by the banks. Yet such safeguards alone will not suffice to avert the dangers that menace the peaceful development of the function of money and fiduciary media in facilitating exchange. Money is part of the mechanism of the free market in a social order based on private property in the means of production. Only where political forces are not antagonistic to private property in the means of production is it possible to work out a policy aiming at the greatest possible stability of the objective exchange value of money.